We'd like to take a second to thank our sponsor, Mouser Electronics. Not only does Mouser stock the world's widest selection of semiconductors and electronic components, they also offer an original content series called Empowering Innovation Together. Each month, EIT takes a deep dive into the hottest tech trends, and this month, the focus is on intelligent transportation systems. Check out podcasts, articles, infographics, videos, and more at mouser.com/empowering-innovation.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devinder Hardwar.
And Reviews Editor Sherlyn Lowe.
And this week, hardware season is in full swing. Not only do we have iPhone 13 reviews, and we have some stuff on the new iPads, Microsoft held their big event, and they released like 8 products, most of which are actually really interesting. There are some that aren't, and we'll talk about all that. So, yeah, join us as we dive into the fall gadget season. As always, if you're enjoying the Engadget Podcast, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes. That's always super helpful. You can also drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. We typically record a live stream around 10 a.m. Eastern on Thursday, so you can join us for that on the Engadget YouTube channel. We do some Q&A during that, too, so that's always a fun time. Check us out. So, Sherlyn, let's talk about one of my favorite times of the year, which is not actually iPhone season. It is when Microsoft tries really, really hard to make us care about what they're doing because everybody loves iPhones. Everybody loves what Apple's doing. Microsoft has to try harder, and I always find that interesting. This week, they showed off the rest of their, basically their new Surface line. We have a Duo 2. We have a sense of what Microsoft is doing, and I think overall it's all pretty interesting, but you were there doing hands-on coverage of these things. What is, you know, your first impression of this entire new product line? We've got the Duo 2, the Pro 8, the Laptop Studio, and you know, a bunch of other stuff that's less important.
Yeah, I was coming off of having the first of my iPhone reviews go up that morning, so I think that it was just really hard to kind of focus
on
one really thing. Yeah, it is. And to your point, too, when you say that, like, yeah, maybe Microsoft has to try really hard. The Surface event usually is in October, right? And they've moved it up this year to September, so that didn't help. But I feel like people do get excited about Surfaces.
I don't know.
It depends. I guess we run in very, very different circles. But anyway, when I got there and when I was, you know, kind of looking at all the materials we got before I got there, just to make sense of what I want to glom onto first, right? I think the first thing I was like, okay, Duo 2, I have to check that out, right? And then
it's your baby, yeah.
Yeah, it is. It is the thing that I reviewed last year. In addition, it's also like the most interesting product that you know, just on the surface, that Microsoft makes. And however, when I got there, you know, I think the Laptop Studio was like, the more I learned about it, the more I was like, This is very interesting.
That one's actually unique. It's very new for them. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what it is though, I don't know if this was made clear in the press materials or the keynote, but the Laptop Studio is going to replace the Laptop Book. Surface Book, yeah.
Where they said this is the book evolved, basically. There was a line like that during the presentation, yeah.
Which basically we've complained a lot on this show about how the Surface Book's design really was holding it back. And now Microsoft has found a way to try to like mitigate that. It's decided to not make it detachable anymore. It's got this pull-forward screen that's easel style. You can have it sit in front of the keyboard closer to you. You can flip it all the way around to face out. You can bring it all the way down to be a tablet. In person, I liked it. It was really, really sharp.
It's unique.
Oh my gosh. Yes. We've seen a lot of laptops like this before. Not to say that like Microsoft is the first to do this, right? Like Acer has been doing this in its Easel branded laptops for a long time.
It's different though. Yeah. So yeah, the thing it reminded me the most of is the HP Folio, that leather HP tablet. I've seen people comment on my story too, saying like some Sony Vaios were doing this even like more than 5 years ago. The idea, just to visualize it, normally it looks like a normal tablet, but you could pull the screen
laptop,
forward,
you mean?
And it kind of like, you pull the screen forward and it kind of like goes over the keyboard. So you can almost like place it right in front of the keyboard for like presentations and stuff. If you pull it all the way forward, it goes down at an angle. So it becomes basically like an easel. So you could do some like really good pen action with that. They're not really selling it as a big tablet as they did with the Surface Book, which I think is good. Because to refresh, the problem with the Surface Book was that all the hardware was behind the screen. So when I reviewed the Surface Book 3 last year, I was like, oh, this is a really nice piece of hardware. The GPU, the dedicated GPU, which is in the keyboard base, is getting better and better. But the core CPU behind that thing was surprisingly slow and underpowered because it had to be behind a very thin screen. And Microsoft just couldn't design around that. Like that was an impending roadblock that would happen from when they started the Surface Book 3. I think looking back at it now, that thing is so crazy over-engineered. It has that crazy hinge where it's like, even just like closing that thing is a problem, right? Because the Surface Book creates this loop and things can fall through it and it doesn't fit flat in the bag. It's just like, it is a mess. It is like, it almost feels like product design run amok. Because I've talked to some Surface Book owners. Most people returned that thing because it was really tough to work with. I don't know anybody who owns one and kept it who actually uses it as a detachable tablet or even, you know, flips the screen around. Like, it's too much trouble. This thing is just like, okay, it's a notebook. And when you feel like it, you pull the screen forward and you pull it down. That's it. Like, there's no detaching. There's no waiting for your operating system to be ready to dock with your external display. There's none of that stuff. So it's a lot simpler in that respect. And again, though, let's talk about the design of this thing, because it looks weird. Not only is the screen weird, the like base of it is weird because
there's a little lip thing.
There's a little lip. It looks like two tablets stacked together. Basically, it is
like
a weird
smaller one on
formation.
Top of a bigger one, right? Yeah,
exactly. I don't know how comfortable that is going to be like on your lap if you're actually using this thing. It is also weird, like, just looking at the hardware. Once again, it maxes out with a quad-core chip. It's Intel's 11th Gen H-Series 35-watt CPU, so a faster chip, but not, like, the fast H-Series that are in gaming laptops. And that is a surprising thing. Like, that's a limitation that most other bigger ultra-portables, like the 15-inchers out there, don't have at all. So again, a weird thing to see Microsoft do. Yeah.
I will say that this design, from what my guess would be, is that like they wanted to have a place to accommodate the new pen. And we can talk about the pen in a little bit. But
sure.
They wanted, I think, not only just a place to accommodate the pen, but to have it sit flush. The pen attaches to this laptop studio with magnets, and it just kind of slides into that little slot underneath, and then the pen will
right
lay
below
flush.
The screen.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Below the keyboard, actually. And then it will lay flush with the rest of the base, which is the protruding part that we're talking about, where there's like two tablets stuck together, right? So I feel like that's part of the reason that this the style and the design that Microsoft adopted. The other, I think I see some vents along the way. So I don't know if like it made sense thermally for them to do this.
It's weird. Yeah. They could have done the pen thing and still have a more powerful processor. Like, we were looking at the XPS 13 last year that had a 6-core CPU. You know, like, we're looking at thin and light laptops that are fitting in, like, Razer Blades with the 8-core super powerful Intel chips. And it's like, what are you doing, Microsoft? If this is the most powerful Surface ever and I can go get a Razer Blade that has an 8-core CPU that is marginally heavier. Like, I think another thing they did is they limited themselves to making this thing 4 pounds at the maximum. So it has a 14.4-inch screen. The base model is like 3.8 pounds, I believe, and the like highest-end model is a straight 4 pounds. So again,
so I will say when I was there, like, I didn't really lift it up to use on my lap a lot. So I didn't really think about that using on your lap format. Right. And I'm sure that with the design issue that you mentioned up, it would definitely feel a little wobbly or uncomfortable on your lap, on your person. And I don't know how heavy it was already. I tend to think of the book as kind of a heftier machine anyway. So the studio as a replacement, probably it should be okay if it was somewhat heavy.
Well, I'm saying they shouldn't have limited themselves to 4 pounds that's what it looks like. Whereas competitors like the Razer Blade go up to like 4.5 at this point, or at least almost 4.5. If you're buying a powerhouse notebook, I think you've resigned yourself to being like, okay, this is going to be a little heavier than, you know, a MacBook Air. Yeah. And that's fine because I'm getting all the power I need. That's not necessarily the case with the Surface Studio, with the Surface Laptop Studio.
Yes.
which is weird because if somebody wants a thin and light Surface, they've got options. They've got the new Pro 8. They've got the Surface Laptop, which is still around. And we'll probably get some like chip refreshes soon. There are other options out there. I feel like they could have like gone a little harder on the power here. Another thing I'll mention is that the screen of the Laptop Studio is really interesting because it is a 120 hertz display.
Mm-hmm.
That is tech we've only seen on gaming laptops. We haven't seen this on productivity machines yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think it's the future. Like we've talked about this when it comes to phones, and it's on the new iPhone Pro. High refresh rates look smoother. That's it.
Yeah.
Like it's objectively a better looking, smoother looking experience. So
we support
120 hertz. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we can get back to this because I feel like 120 hertz is going to keep coming up throughout this episode.
Yes.
Yeah. But the thing to your point, Devendra, you sent me a very good question to ask the people at the store at the event when I was checking out the Laptop Studio, and this doesn't do adaptive refresh rates either. It's not adjusting on its own to see, hey, if you're scrolling, we'll bump it up. Hey, if you're, you know, inking and drawing, we'll bump it up and then drop it back down to a more battery efficient level. Otherwise, this is just constantly at 120 hertz unless you turn it to 60 hertz yourself, like when you know you're at the airport, you know, and you want more juice.
You have to be smart enough to go into your Windows settings. And it's not even like an immediate thing, right? You have to right-click on your desktop, go to display settings, go to more display settings, go down to the little Dropbox, find the little hertz, and check it there. So it's like a three-level in menu option. I think, and they say in all the marketing, it's going to be 60 hertz by default. So I think this is almost like 4K TVs. A lot of people are going to buy this and not even know they have this power.
So the 60 hertz default, I don't know necessarily where you saw it. What the person, the product manager at the event.
It's in all the written stuff.
Yeah, what the product manager told me at the event and what I've written in my hands-on, so I just want to make sure we're on the same page, is that like the 60 hertz default is for the Surface Pro 8, which also has 120 hertz capability, but out of the box, it comes at 60 hertz. Whereas according to this product manager I spoke to, the Studio comes out of the box with 120 hertz as the default. So we'll have to check with Microsoft just to make sure they're also on the same page, you know what I mean? Just because
there
should
be an easier way to change that. I think that's the ultimate
thing. Like a quick button, maybe, or just adaptive. Give us an adaptive option.
I think they're in a weird place because one of the new interesting things coming to Windows 11 is adaptive sync. So it's like if you have a higher hertz display, the OS just does it. Like if you're scrolling, it's like, okay, boom, higher refresh rate. If you're just staring at an article, lowers it to say battery life. Like you shouldn't have to think about it. That's how more modern machines and smartphones, I think, are doing it too.
Smartphones mostly, yes.
So hey, we're going to need to see more of that. But it's pretty cool that this has 120 hertz. It's also a Dolby Vision HDR screen, which, again, we've seen that on some computers, but we haven't seen Dolby Vision plus high refresh rate.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is going to be a beautiful looking screen.
It did look really, really good. So I'll tell you what I managed to do at my hands-on, and we can use this to kind of segue into talking about the new Slim Pen 2. I am no artist. I will admit I have no drawing skills whatsoever, but I was able to work on a watercolor piece that was already done sort of halfway through with some purple petals and flowers. And like the watercolor effect on that screen, holy crap. It felt like this is where 120 hertz refresh rates shine, where like the second I kind of just dipped the pen onto the screen, it really felt like water was just dissipating out of the nib. It felt like things were flowing, like I was truly drawing like on water and paper. I don't want to be too hyperbolic here. I you know, haven't compared this watercolor experience with another device, so maybe I'm just blown away by apps. I was using Adobe Fresco, to be clear. Yeah,
it's a combination of a bunch of things too, because they're talking about that high refresh rate, which is, again, it's gonna be on the Pro 8, and we'll get to that. Not only scrolling, but writing, art, yes, drawing on the screen will make it seem more organic. It'll, yes, feel more realistic. And the Slim Pen 2, which we're kind of hinting at,
yes,
is also cool because it's slimmer than before and it has haptic feedback. So you kind of get, yes, that resistance and that feeling of putting pen to paper and pencil to paper or something, which is, okay, I'm down with that. Yeah.
I was so weirded out by this pen when I first started using it on this laptop, uh-huh, studio, because I was like, it's supposed to mimic pen and paper, but then like it sort of felt like a weird draggy thing. Like it felt like it dragged and wasn't this. I don't know if I was just having the nip at too sharp of an angle to the screen.
Yeah.
And the haptic feedback is cool. If only when like every time I pushed it onto the screen and the water, like I said, the paint would, you know, dissipate out, there was this slight vibration. Like, but no, it doesn't, cool, real pens don't vibrate when you But like a real paintbrush doesn't vibrate when you're doing watercolor.
It doesn't vibrate, really, but you feel something. You feel resistance, right, and maybe they have to fine tune that.
They do have to fine tune. You can adjust the intensity. I really
like the idea of the Slim Pen too. Like it looks cool. It is $130, so that's extra. And now you're into the Surface world where all the really cool accessories are extra. So, you know, there's that. There's a lot of stuff we're going to be keeping an eye on. Anything else you want to mention about the Surface Studio while we're at it?
Yeah, one last note is that the screen is ridiculously thin. It's very thin and, it was easy to maneuver, but maybe a bit too easy. Like at some point it was a little wobbly, with the screen on its frame sort of hinged. So we'll see. We'll see in person how it does. I mean, not in person, but when we're, you know, using it in the real world.
So the Surface Laptop Studio is also going to start at $1,600, which puts it like in the price range of powerful 15-inch computers. Still much less than the MacBook Pro 16-inch, which has 9th-gen Intel CPUs and still starts at like $2,400. So they gotta update that bad boy, as much as I like that computer. Let's move on to the Surface Pro 8, which I think it is it is the quintessential Surface. This is the one with the kickstand. This is the one with the keyboard accessory. It is a tablet that transforms into a PC with all this stuff. And I think it is a nice shift forward design-wise. Like this is the biggest Surface redesign since the Surface Pro 3. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to count the Pro X. We'll talk about that separately. But it did bring in some design elements from the Pro X, right? It has thinner bezels along the sides. The top and the bottom of the screen, still a little chunky, but the sides look a lot better. The screen is bigger. It's 13 inches, and it also supports 120 hertz Dolby Vision, just like the laptop studio. So that is really interesting to have a tablet that has all that great screen tech. It's very iPad Pro-like, so I kind of see what Microsoft is aiming at here. And it also finally has Thunderbolt displays, which the laptop studio has as well. So Thunderbolt ports. So before last year, not last year, 2 years ago, when you reviewed the Pro 7 Trillin, it had USB-C. You could charge over USB-C, but you couldn't plug in Thunderbolt devices because it just didn't have the technology. This is the first time Microsoft is finally embracing it, which means you can plug in really fast hard drives. You could plug in multiple 4K monitors.
Up to two.
And also external GPUs. Yeah, up to two, which is...
Yeah.
That's pretty cool from a single tiny device.
I only have two eyes. I'm good, yeah.
You're good. Also supports external GPUs. So if anybody has those things, I do feel like the dream of external GPUs has died, but it's still a thing that exists and is out there. So if you have an enclosure and you want like some real power, you could plug into this. It looks like a nice Surface. How did it feel to you compared to the Pro 7?
When I picked it up, I was expecting it to feel a lot like the Pro X, the Snapdragon the ARM-based Pro X. And it was actually, though, surprisingly heavier, to the point where I was like questioning myself. I was like, wait, why is this so much heavier?
Is it heavier? It is heavier than the Pro 7 was. Yeah.
Specifically, I think because it has to, you know, accommodate like battery and you know the required power necessary to keep the Intel cards running, and then its ventilation system is built differently from the Pro X, which was the ARM-based one that I'm talking about.
Is the size of it like the size of there's more glass too? I think that's the biggest thing. If the screen is bigger, probably, there's more glass. So
I was able to put a Surface 7 Plus and a Surface Pro 8 next to each other, and like you can see the screen is bigger. The size of it is not that much different. Just again, shaving bezels will do that for you. It doesn't feel huge enough. It really feels very sleek. And then the vents along the edges are different from the Pro X as well. So the kickstand was also like super extra thin, right? But like in the same way that the Pro X had a thin kickstand, I think this is still very sturdy. It's all down to the performance now, really. And that's something that requires testing.
I think the ultimate thing looking at this and looking at the specs, it does seem like that I think this is a Surface Pro that can really go toe-to-toe with like an actual ultra-portable laptop. Whereas before, they had like 12.4-inch screens. They were a little smaller. They were a little limited in terms of what you were getting. Would you get an XPS 13 or a Surface Pro 7? The vast majority of people would just get an XPS 13,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's,
this has a 13-inch screen. It has everything. Go ahead.
Yeah, no. I was just thinking, I when you said XPS 13, this reminded me. When we were talking about the Studio 2, I had the same thought. When I get a laptop, just use it in laptop mode. But for something like the Surface Pro 8, you know, it's something more purpose-built for, like, on the go. I feel like that's my, like, airport machine. If I, you know, needed something extra or I had the means to get something extra, that's what I would take with me when I'm traveling. But a laptop like this, the laptop studio is less for me. You know what I mean? Like it's, I don't need my desktop substitute-y thing to do that. It would be nice, sure, to have the screen come forward and watch videos and play games on.
Imagine working on the plane and how annoying working on a plane is.
I'm not going to take the studio on the plane though because it's so heavy.
Why not?
It's heavy.
4 pounds. 4 pounds.
The Pro 8. Tell me how the Pro 8 weighs.
If you could take the Pro 8 weighs exactly 2 pounds on its own,
but the keyboard
usually adds like another full pound. So it's going to be like it's going to be almost 3 pounds. And that's it. So the thing is, and the reason I think it's a better machine for more people is just because that screen is finally 13 inches. It finally has Thunderbolt. It does everything what you'd want a 13-inch ultra portable to do. So it's at least a good option. Maybe like here, Surface was never meant for everybody. I do think for your workflow, Sherlyn, like given when we were traveling, when we were moving around, being able to be more flexible and have something that's more than just a laptop or something that could be simplified to being all screen would actually be really useful. But hey, it's hard to visualize that when we're all still pretty much stuck at home and not traveling too much. So all in all, I think the Surface Pro 8 looks really cool. It is a nice update. Like, it is the update I've wanted for a very long time. Has slightly better cameras. The keyboard is still separate. So even though it starts at $1,100, expect to spend another $100 to $150, depending on the type of keyboard. There is a charging keyboard, too. The Pro type cover.
But that is the
signature. That is the most expensive. And you have to buy that cover. And you have to spend another $150 for the pen.
Yep.
All extra costs because that's how Microsoft
sticker shock,
with the
y'all.
Surface line.
Yep. Before I know, there's a lot more from the Surface event. I did want to highlight two more things,
Duo 2.
The Duo 2 is so interesting as just a device and as a concept. It's funny to me that they're already on the second generation of the Duo, but the Neo is still nowhere to be seen, right?
They said so, and we've talked about this with people. They said like we're not working on the Neo anymore.
Yeah.
Like they said like it's paused. So I don't know what that means. If we'll see it next year, it eventually, or. Right. Maybe what they need to do is like keep designing and just release what would be the second version of the Neo. Because looking at the Duo 2 now, this looks a lot better than last year's phone.
The main differences here, right, are first of all, I think this is the biggest difference, is that like now it's got a triple rear camera system. As like in the past, it only had one, I believe 10 or 11 megapixel camera on board, and you were supposed to use that as both your front and rear camera.
Yeah. It was above the display.
It was on the inside, it was above the display. And the main issue with this is that like Microsoft thought its software would be smart. Well, thought its software and Android software, right, would be smart enough to know like which side of the camera or which side of the screen it would need to turn on based on how you were holding and using the device or the camera. And that was, I think, the cause of all the issues it was having with the camera software. It was just really buggy, never knew which camera to have out. So this time around, it's got both like front and rear cameras, except for this bump. Holy mackerel. Like, what the hell? It's about as thick as the phone. It's a big bump.
Yeah.
This is okay. So, you know how we have a scale on this show? This is a chonky bump. This is the chunkiest bump, especially compared to
if you stuff this into like a pair of jeans, I could see that bump keeping, it's going to get jammed in like that mm-hmm. little like metal dot that's on all our jean pockets for some reason.
Yeah.
It's going to be a mess. Yeah.
So that also makes it so that you can't really just flip the two screens all the way around so that they're all facing outwards. You can still do that, but then you can't have it lay flat and flush against each other, which is like a minor annoyance to some people, but B, it just removes for me completely any credibility this thing had as a phone. To use a camera too, you can also no longer do it like that way, where you can flip it all the way around to have it like as a phone-sized camera thing.
Sure.
You have to have the rear camera unobstructed, right? So you can't open it more than 180 degrees because otherwise you start seeing the back of the other screen. And then, you basically have to have the two screens open.
They need to give you a basically like the way the iPhone can let you take a photo right from the lock screen. Like they need to give you a way.
Yeah.
To just like take photos without even opening it. So
yeah,
good
but
luck. There's a lot of usability they didn't think about.
That's why without an external display, this is one of the challenges. This is why the Fold 3 and stuff like that, like they have an external display. But again, I don't ever want to see anyone take a photo with the Duo 2 out in the wild holding it up like a tablet, because I will feel very bad for you that you drop $1,500 on this device only to look like you're taking photos with an iPad mini.
People love to take photos with their tablets. Come on. A couple other good things. This one has a modern processor, finally, the Snapdragon 888. It has, I think, the camera, like, it's having multiple cameras is just going to be the big thing. It also has, like, this little notification bar for when it's closed, which is very Samsung. That's very Galaxy Edge, but it is a cool thing to see, like, underneath the hinge there. Yeah.
They didn't show it to me at the event, so I completely didn't. They kept telling me, they were like, oh, so we like made the inside edge of the screen curve a little bit more. It's more beveled. I was like, oh, cool. Mm-hmm. I guess. What's
nice,
the point?
Nice.
But then and then they were like, oh, this is a notifications glance bar or whatever. So based on the videos I saw, I didn't see this and I didn't get to see this in person because like they didn't tell me about it. But it basically is a very, very teeny tiny sliver of screen that peeks out from between the two screens under the hinge. And
like a page, like the one line of screen you get in an old pager, like an LED.
Oh,
like,
okay. Even shorter than that, even. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it will flash colors, sure, to show you something's going on when you have the screens, when the device closed. But it'll also like show some icons, right? I don't know how useful mm-hmm. the icon thing part of it is going to be. My eyesight's really, really not that great.
I don't know. It looks like the Cylon imagery from Battlestar Galactica, which I like. I grew up watching Knight Rider. So give me my LEDs in a single line that move back and forth. That's when
it
you know, like
cool.
when the machine takeover begins, all your Surface Duo 2s will just start flashing red. So get ready for that.
All in all, though,
I think this is a better one. I could see people buying this one. It is expensive, starting at $1,500, but most like crazy high level phones now, the iPhone Pro Max is going to get you close to there too. If you want a foldable of some kind, this is basically a foldable without actual screens that fold. So it is still nice in that respect.
Yeah. I'm going to cautiously be saying that I don't think people are going to buy this still, because like I need to see what the software is like first, because that was the biggest issue with the original, you know, like a lot of the supposed functions for a multi-screen device like this just didn't work very well.
You should talk to Jess. You should talk to our Jessica.
I know. I have.
Because we were talking about this on the post stream, and Jess
y'all.
Is really into getting the Duo 2. Yeah,
we had a little chat after. I was like, "Girl, calm down." No.
Calm down, relax.
Yes.
Okay, so we're going to have to move on to iPhone stuff soon, but let's quickly round out, because I think the rest of the stuff is just kind of hilarious almost. So they didn't update the Pro X at all. The Pro X, which was like 2 years ago, it was 2 years ago. That was like the design forward surface, the one built on ARM, thinner bezels, thinner like overall case. It is still using the SQ2 processor they developed last year. That was thrown into it, and there is now a cheaper model, which is nice. It starts at $899, but nothing else is different. I think we're all waiting to see how Windows 11 will kind of work on this thing, because the idea is that it will have built-in software emulation for X64. So it can run any Windows app, technically. We'll see. The original Surface Pro X did not do that, and it was a nightmare to use because of that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And there is a...
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I'm just moving on. I'm moving down the line. There's also a new Go 3, which is their, you know, cheap boy, the cheap small boy. And I think it's going to replace like the base Surface line. It starts at $400 with like, you know, an underpowered CPU. Again, keyboard is separate, so that's another $100. But for kids or for people who don't need like a giant tablet, it's not a bad deal. Like a $400 to $500 PC that also turns into a tablet that can be used with a kickstand that has a lot of good tech. I've always liked the Surface line, the Surface Go line. The Go 2 that I reviewed last year was really solid. So I imagine it's just going to be more and more of the good stuff. They also announced the Surface Adaptive Kit, which is a really cool thing where for people who, you know, disabled users who have basically want help finding particular keys or finding particular ports. Like these are translucent stickers, transparent stickers that could be put on there to help you figure out the keys. There are port recognition stickers and cable ties that can mm-hmm. be color coordinated to help you figure it out. There are ways to open up the Surface, things that give you more leverage, like a ring that you can pull, or like a pull tab to pull out the Surface kickstand. I think that's all super cool, and it's a big step towards usability. And I know you like you care a lot about this, Sherlyn.
Yeah, I definitely wanted to give time to kind of recognize that Microsoft did announce this. It's not the like they're not the first, obviously, to make like stickers to turn any laptop more touch friendly, especially for visually impaired people who want to feel out the keyboard and don't really, you know, feel enough with the existing nibs on keyboards, the little nubs that are already there. And then also, like, I just want to say, because we've interviewed Microsoft's chief accessibility officer, Jenny Leigh Fleury, a couple of times now, it feels like because they have someone who at the helm who's, like, herself very thoughtful about these things, this is why Microsoft is sort of leading the way a little bit with things like this, the Adaptive Kit and the Adaptive Xbox Adaptive Controller. So I am glad that a company as big as Microsoft is giving accessibility the attention it deserves, and hopefully, and Apple mm-hmm. too in some ways, but hopefully more companies make a bigger effort like this. That's yeah, all I gotta
Microsoft
say.
Microsoft has a whole division focused on accessibility and usability for all sorts of users. So mm-hmm. I think that's not something we see at most companies. We don't know the price of this thing yet. I hope it is cheap. I hope it's like $20 at the most, because it has to be price accessible as well as everything else. So please don't make this $50, Microsoft, because we're already paying way too much for those Surface keyboards.
Yeah.
All right. Microsoft's done. Let's move on to all of our Apple stuff. And to help us chat about it is our comms editor, Valentina Palladino. Hello, Valentina.
Hi, guys. How are you guys doing?
Hello. You sound excited.
Already, I am excited. I am.
You reviewed the iPad mini. You're as pumped as Sherlyn is about this review
Super
hell.
Super pumped.
Oh, we're living God. In.
Poor Valentina. She stepped up and helped out with the iPad mini because, I mean, there's just so much stuff going on. Valentina's also at the same time reviewing the Fitbit Charge 5 for us, which, yes, she's going to do a really great job testing that out. I'm so grateful I don't have to wear that goddamn thing to sleep. Anyway.
It's not that bad. You'd be surprised. It's not small.
It looks good, but the thing I don't want to wear anything to be. Anyway,
I get it.
So iPhone and iPad reviews are all up. Basically, ours. My Pro reviews are coming very soon. Our iPad 9 reviews also coming very soon. We just needed time. We have people need to take breaks. But yes, I started out with the iPhone 13 and 13 mini. And Valentina, I don't know how you feel about, you're an iPhone user, I think.
Yes, I am.
So you're on a fairly recent iPhone as well. So for me, the question going into the review was, is this a worthwhile upgrade? And if so, for who? Like for an iPhone 12 person or an iPhone 11 person? I also wanted to make sure I compared it fairly to existing devices in Android. So that's a lot to get into in one review, but I tried. Hopefully that comes across.
I think you did a great job.
Yeah, I promise I wasn't fishing. But yes, so what would your like Val from a point of view of person who's like been using the iPhone, like a recent iPhone, what would your most like important question be about the iPhone 13 and 13 mini?
Well, I guess, I mean, as like you said, as someone who does use an iPhone and I have an iPhone XR, so I am a little bit, I'm like due for an update, I guess, what people might think is due for an update. But it's only, I think, 3 years old at this point, in December when I got it. But yeah, I mean, that's my biggest question would be like, is this enough of an update?
yeah,
to warrant yeah. me spending possibly what $800 or more.
Yeah.
And which one is the best one to go with versus the regular 13 series or the Pro series? Yeah. I know we haven't gotten into a Pro review just yet. But yeah, I mean that's from my perspective, because that me as a real world user, yep, I was yep. considering updating and getting a new iPhone. Mm-hmm. And I have my thoughts on that. But yeah, that's the question I would pose to you is like, for someone like me who is running on an older iPhone.
Yes.
Older.
Yes.
Older. Is it worth the update?
I feel like the 10R, and I think Devendra is in a similar spot because you've mm-hmm. been considering getting one with for your wife. The iPhone 13.
I got the 12 for my wife last year.
Oh,
and
okay.
She's good. And okay,
so
no
you don't need
upgrade,
you don't feel like okay. Basically. So yeah, I agree. Yeah. For people who are coming off of something as recent as the 12, you don't need the upgrade no. probably unless you're like really, really must have cinematic mode. This is one of the newest things. It's based, mm-hmm. it's contingent on the A15 processor. So like older cameras can't just get it through a software update. So like, okay, I don't think your wife is going to be like cinematically taking videos of your daughter anytime soon, Dev.
She's not, I mean, we take a lot of videos, but she probably doesn't need that. I think the conversation is different for pro users, but we'll get there.
Yeah, we'll get there. I definitely feel like people, mm-hmm. Valentina, my advice to you would be to get the 13 Pro, but I will tell you why later. Yes. But, I think we all agree on this one. So at $699, the Mini is still kind of hard to recommend anyone buy just because the battery life is still shorter than every other smartphone out there.
But better than before, yes.
Because it's so small. Like any device this small that's like got modern components, it's not going to last long enough. It's just that's kind of the way we are. But the regular iPhone 13 that's a bit bigger, that has bigger cameras than before, has yeah, slight bumps in photography. You have a smaller notch, which like LOL, no. It's still there. It's still there. And it's pretty huge. iOS 15 things you can get on basically any phone. As a jump from the 10R, Valentina, if you're trying to maybe save the $200 difference from the iPhone 13 and 13 Pro, like it's still a good upgrade because it feels fresh and new. And it's got the dual cameras because the 10R only has one. And it's got decent battery life. But here's why. And I think that we don't need to spend too much time on the 13 and 13 mini. You can go read my review. It's already up. Exhaustively covered everything. The reason we all should be getting the Pro if we're considering upgrading this year is the 120Hz refresh rate. There's no...
That screen, baby!
That screen! Yeah. Like, I swear to God, I am at the point now where like, I'm so grateful I've moved on to the iPhone 13 Pro reviews because I don't need to use that shitty-ass 60Hz screen.
Wow.
Yeah, like a commoner. No 60Hz for you. But this is what I'm telling everybody. Like, you look at a high refresh rate screen, you're like, oh, my life is different now. There is before I saw this screen, and then there's after I saw this screen, and I need these screens. So, yes. I think I will. A lot of people will agree with you, Shirley.
Valentina, let me pose this question to you: how much of your phone time do you think is spent scrolling? Let me just pose this.
Oh,
question.
Too much, too much.
Right.
Every week when I get that notification, that screen time notification of how many hours I've spent on my phone this week, I just like I fall, I like crumple into this like little. I feel terrible about all the time that I'm like just scrolling mindlessly. Yeah. So in that case, I guess screen time is working because it's guilting me to stop doing that. But yeah, I mean the scrolling on a screen that's better, like on the Pros, is just I've experienced it with the iPhone. I mean with the iPad Pros. So like I totally understand that bringing that into your life in a smaller form, kind of smaller, with the iPhones, would definitely be an upgrade for sure.
So when I was thinking about, I didn't want. So I know that this is a new feature for people in Apple world, right? So that's why I was like, look, I can already imagine people going like, "What's the big deal about 120?" I don't know why that's the voice I chose.
If they have iPad Pros or if they've seen any of that, that's the one area where Apple has like really gone hard on screens.
Maybe. So I meant like Apple phone world, iPhone world, right?
Yep.
For those of us in the Android phone world, we've had this for years. We know what high refresh rates look like.
Don't act like every Android phone
not
had
every.
That, Shirley. Come on.
But even the mid-range ones now. Even
the
mid-range ones now have them. Yes.
Yeah.
They've been around. They've been around to the point where we've got like, on cheaper phones, we've even got 90Hz screens. You know what I mean? Like better than, not 120, but better than 60. Anyway, I wanted to make it clear why it's so important. So I think I spent a bunch of my review, which I filed and we're just going to put up tomorrow, explaining how much of my life is just scrolling. Just think about it. I'm scrolling. whether it's social feeds like Twitter or whatever, or your email, or when you're writing, or you're looking at your conversation history to be like, what did this bitch say about me? Or like, you know, it's just all of
you
your
smooth, like angry text scrolling. Also, like, so I don't know if any games fully support this yet too, but I can imagine like some of the like faster paced mobile games will end up looking a lot better on that screen too. But that's, I wouldn't get it for games. I get it for the scrolling. And that's the other thing too. Like, if you want to be doing less doom scrolling in your life, maybe you'll want to make it look less pretty. So I don't know.
Yeah, it's a philosophical question. Yeah, in that way. And you know, if you're doing things that require like a lot of input, like the Vindra said, gaming, or even if you draw on your phone with your fingers for some, you know, at some part, it's the 120 hertz screen is going to help make it feel a lot more fluid, a lot more natural. So anyway, I'm beating a dead horse here at this point. This 120 hertz screen, big deal. In fact, like after I'm so torn because like I'm going to upgrade to the 13 as my main, like, because I have to main two phones nowadays. I've been maining the 12 and I want to main the 13, not the 13 Pro, because it's got the pink. I got the pink one. It's so nice. But
is disappointing. Screw this is really disappointing that. Here.
Yeah.
Do the pro, put a pink case on it and be happy with
He's got a point.
Get the leather. Is there a pink leather case yet? Those leather cases are really hot.
I'll look for the pink. The pink is nice. I got a rosy one.
Yeah. The pink is very pretty. I will say that about the iPhone 13. But anyway, moving on to the rest of the Pro and Pro Max's features. The cameras, I mean, they seriously upgraded the hardware here. Apple gave us bigger sensors. One of them even has an f1.5 aperture, the main one, which is like huge. Photography is great. I've compared the photos I took with the S21 Ultra with the Pros, as well as the Pixel 5, which Google didn't make a bigger one last year.
Did you do macro mode testing at all?
I did.
I don't think Apple has really talked about that much, but for a lot of folks, that, like, being able to go really big on like a small thing is going to be a big deal.
Stories for you.
Yeah. Okay.
So okay. I was so excited to try out macro mode. I've tried it out on the OnePlus, I think 9. I can't remember which exact OnePlus model also added a macro mode. And it is hilarious to me that, okay, so first of all, Apple does this thing where it doesn't like offer like a macro mode that you switch on and off, right? It just, it wants to be intuitive. So once you get close to your subject, right, when you get close, it will automatically switch over. So you'll see actual on the UI, the thing changes in front of you. And then it looks like you're shifting cameras basically, right? But then like it is buggy right now, and Apple has said it will issue a software update soon to fix this, but it constantly switches back and forth as like while you're getting close to your subject. So it's like doesn't know like what camera to use sort of. So that's one thing, and that's the thing that Apple said it will fix. I haven't seen the fix yet, so I can't tell you if it works really well. I will say when I am up close in macro mode, it also switches focus on things, because when you're in a very busy background and like, for example, for my testing, I did a lot of like leaves on trees or whatever. It would focus on the right leaf that I wanted and then midway through just switch focus to the one in behind it. I think this has to do with the fact that I was getting too close to my intended subject, right? It's only for up to 2 cm away, 2 centimeters away. So once I started to get too close to my
subject. Getting closer than 2 centimeters away?
I was all up in this bee's business, to be honest. It really was. But all that said, when I was using it, when I did manage to snap the pictures from macro mode, good Lord, were they beautiful. It didn't look great on my phone because I think the HEIC format just didn't save in like very nice colors. But then when I exported and uploaded them to Instagram or to just my photos app on the phone, holy crap, y'all, I can see hairs on leaves. It's very pretty.
It's all we need to see. Like, imagine living in a world where you could see all the hairs.
Ant-Man, I'll see you. You can't hide from me, Paul Rudd. Anyway.
Did you play with cinematic mode too?
Yeah.
Did you give that a shot?
Dude, yep. So Valentina, you can shoot all the best videos of your cat from now on with
cinematic. I would love to do that. I'm always looking for the next way to level up my cat photos and videos. Yeah, yeah.
Cinematic mode actually does look really great. It does. But with a few caveats. One is that like I tested this on our video producer Brian O, who's, you know, a beautiful subject, and his adorable dog Zen, and the iPhone 13 was and the 13 Pro, they were both very good at like identifying subjects in the scene. They were, the yellow boxes appeared, the white boxes appeared, and it will keep focus on the area that it thinks you should focus on. And I did the same thing that they did in the announcement video, where like you turn your head and move your eye, like gaze away from the camera, and it just starts to shift to the background, shift the focus to the background. All of that works fine. With just the fact, the intensity of the effect can be very weird if you have it like set to max aperture. So like the highest setting, so like the biggest opening, so F1, whatever, F2 actually. But it's at that stage that like you lose hairs on your like head, or you lose like an ear, or you lose like a nose to the blur. Like Apple is just like, well, no, you don't need a nose. It's just whatever.
You don't.
Yeah.
Fine.
It's lost in the blur in the background. So there's that. So like, but we found that adjusting the f-stop, which you can do on cinematic mode, will lessen that. It's still not that great. It still feels like, I think I saw one review say that it still feels like the early days of portrait mode photos, where like phones still weren't very smart at knowing what's your head and what's like background. But when it works, it looks really nice. The other thing I struggled with cinematic mode is that sometimes it just can't focus on two things at once, even if they're on the same plane. But this feels more like something Apple could fix and will fix quickly enough. So yeah, no. Do I think cinematic mode alone is worth upgrading from the 12 to the 13? No. I personally don't think so. You can shoot great videos without it.
And it's limited to 1080p 30fps, which is going to be a deal breaker for some people. Because I do, at this point, I'm doing everything 4K 60 because I want that like nice baby footage, you know?
Yeah.
And that would be the reason I would upgrade too, just to have like a better pro camera and to have like stuff like macro mode, other things, like other nice capabilities, less so for cinematic mode, because you're kind of like, you have to do a project. You want to have a project in mind to do cinematic mode. You're not going to do like everyday kids running around videos in cinematic mode. Yeah.
I will say that using cinematic mode, I use iMovie to make some really silly videos of Brian, his dog, and our friends as superheroes. And it's freaking amazing because it somehow introduced this professional quality to the video, where like the trailer came out looking like I really did shoot a trailer video. Man. So it was
I can't wait to see what kids do with this. Like just a kid having a phone that has some really cool that has some really cool focus capabilities. There's that. So anything else you guys want to mention about the phones or the pros, Sterling? Because we got to get to the iPad Mini.
Yeah,
It's probably the most interesting device Apple launched this year. So
I hear you. I hear you. No, I would say just like read our full reviews or watch our full reviews. The Pro review is coming out tomorrow.
Any sense of battery life improvements? I was looking at a lot of reviews and everyone was like, holy crap, this is like a major leap forward for batteries.
The Pros are insane. The Pros last so long that I can't even run a battery test because it'll take me too long to run the test. Like I need to use the phone and like I can't have a phone just running a battery test for 2 days. So we're going to have to go live with our reviews soon, but tell you that like in anecdotal testing, blah, blah, blah. And then I'll update with like battery test results soon. But yes, the Pro Max lasts forever and ever, but it's also bigger and heavier and has that's not the phone for me, but if you want like something,
I don't know who the Pro Max is for. I still don't know because I've talked to a lot of folks and even like bigger, taller people with huge hands. The Pro Max still weighs half a pound. It's too heavy.
Did the 13 like gain any weight from the 12? Is it a little bit heavier? Mm. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because my fiance has the 12 Pro Max and he just loves it because he likes that to have that gigantic screen. You know what I mean? And the battery life that comes along with like the largest phone that you can get. So
you know what's a good alternative though? Maybe instead of a bigger iPhone, how about a smaller iPad?
Right?
What a segue.
So yeah, the iPad Mini. I mean, this is the most significant update to the iPad Mini we've seen in a very long time. You could say since it came out, if you really wanted to get a little spicy, but certainly since the 2019 version came out, that's for sure. So that the 2019 version was kind of just like internal updates with the processor and stuff like that. But this is a whole new redesign. Kind of looks like a mini iPad Air. You know, it has the what Apple is calling an all-screen design, which, you know, is different. It's a different name than the edge-to-edge screens on the Pros. But essentially, it's the same sort of design where you have this kind of black bezel, you know, curving all the way around the screen and flat edges. So, and because of that, there's no physical home button, obviously, but there is one of those power buttons that the Air has with Touch ID on it. So you have that form of logging in, that biometric authentication. And then some, you know, volume rockers and such, but you don't have a headphone jack on this one. And I bring that up because the 2019 Mini did have a headphone jack. So that is, I think, probably a small difference to most people. Yeah. But if you are considering updating from the 2019 Mini, that's something that you're losing. So just be aware
of that. This is me throwing my hands up in the air, just cursing Apple. Like, of course, you create this perfect little beautiful device and ruin it by taking away the 3.5 millimeter jack.
And I'm sure there will still be people who are angry about that. But I think a lot of us, especially us who like kind of live our lives in this like tech world, kind of saw that coming, you know. But it is something that you will lose if you're updating from the 2019 Mini, which is kind of a hard decision to make, I think, but we'll get into that. So yeah, a totally updated design. It has, you know, the A15 Bionic chip, which makes it super fast, very zippy, really great to, you know, use as my daily driver over the past like week-ish, you know, just when I'm sitting on the couch or, you know, kind of using it for everything that I was using my iPhone for the majority of the time that I've been using it. And then it also has, we can't forget, USB-C charging, which is another really great update, finally. 5G support, so you can you could technically kind of use this as a phone if you wanted to. I wouldn't recommend it, but
the option is there. Samsung Note people are out there, and like they're almost there.
Exactly. So, I mean, do what you want. Go off. You can do that. And also, they have the iPad Mini has improved cameras. So there's a 12 megapixel rear camera and then a 12 megapixel front facing camera. And that front facing camera has Apple's center stage feature. So when you're, you know, FaceTiming with someone, the camera kind of pans and zooms to track you and try to keep your face in the center of the frame. And that was really cool. That's kind of one of my favorite newish features that Apple has, just because it makes FaceTime calls much better, I think. For someone like me specifically, who is usually multitasking when I'm on a FaceTime call, because I'm usually FaceTiming with either a friend or like my mom or my dad or someone, and I'm usually like in my kitchen or like going around my apartment and like trying to clean stuff up or something. And I'm usually moving all around the frame and sometimes out of frame. So yeah, it's cool to like kind of have it do that, you know, automatically without you having to pick up the actual, you know, tablet and move it around. And it works with the second generation Apple Pencil, which also for me, I am someone who really likes, you know, digital doodling and note taking and stuff like that. So it was really great to kind of use the iPad Mini as a kind of digital notebook. And I think it really excels at that, particularly because of its size.
Yeah. How does it feel to hold? Does it feel more comfortable basically than having, I don't know if you've tried out the old iPad Air. I would say they didn't upgrade the iPad Air. So that's actually a pretty bad purchase right now, given the power and given the capabilities that's in the iPad Mini. This seems like they just decided to shrink the Air and assumed maybe a lot of people would jump on that. I'm really hyped about it just because of that. But could you like hold this thing for a while on the couch and stuff?
Yeah, I was actually surprised. I was able to kind of type with it. Actually, I have it right here. I can kind of hold it up for you. Yay. So I've actually been able to kind of type like this way more easily than I thought I was going to be able to do.
And for the listener, like this means like you're holding it with two hands vertically. Yeah,
like a phone, like portrait
phone. As if you were holding an iPhone or whatever phone. So yeah, with your thumbs on the center of the screen, essentially. So I was surprised by how easily I just kind of fell into doing that and treating it almost like a really big iPhone. So it is really nice to hold. And it is, I mean, I own an 11-inch iPad Pro from 2020. So not the most recent one, but the model before that. And it's, compared to that, it is so much easier to just kind of tote around my apartment. I can literally have like a YouTube video on and just kind of go around doing my errands, cleaning things up. And yeah, it really became this probably the easiest iPad to take with me wherever I was going, whether it was outside my apartment or inside the apartment. It was like my phone. It became a larger phone that came with me with my phone, if that makes sense.
I'm so tempted because it's sort of like I've long dreamed of having like a little digital portfolio, you know, something bigger than my phone, but something that's not a laptop, right? If I take my daughter to the park and she's out there playing, and I just want to like type an email or something quickly, I can imagine getting this. Maybe eventually Logitech or somebody else will make like a keyboard case. So you can have like a nice little keyboard next to it. Apple isn't making one, which I think is very, very telling. I would love to see a cute like fold out Apple keyboard on this thing.
I feel like that might be a little bit too, I feel like that might be a little bit too small. Like, I actually think it might be good that Apple's not making a keyboard case for this thing. I'm sure somebody else will eventually, but since it does have Bluetooth, you know, you could hook up, you could get one of Apple's like, you know, little smart folio cases, or just another case that allows you to prop the mini up in front of you and then use like a regular Bluetooth keyboard, something compact, obviously, if you want to take it with you. I think that might be the better option just for typing, purely because of the ergonomics of it, you know?
Yep. For sure. I'm really excited about this thing. Anything else you want to mention, Valentina, about it? Like, it starts at $499. The one I kind of want would be the 256 gigabyte Wi-Fi model, so that's $650. And then you're like, then you're getting up there, and if you want the cellular, then it's like more and more, then that's a lot.
It gets very expensive very fast, and that's kind of the disappointing part about the iPad mini. I think number one, that it starts off $100 more expensive than the previous iPad mini, so that right there kind of makes the decision to upgrade if you have an older iPad mini a little bit more of a toss-up, because are you willing to spend that extra $100 just to get 64 gigabytes of storage, which is another kind of con in my opinion, just because if you're going to use the iPad mini, like you said, Dev, kind of as like a digital portfolio of sorts, or something where you're going to keep kind of your digital life in terms of notes, documents, even photos and videos sometimes, you know, like all of those things eat up space. And, you know, iPad OS is only going to take up, you know, more and more space as it becomes more robust.
You're going to want games on this thing. You're going to want things that are big. Yeah,
exactly. So the 64 gigabytes might get eaten up very quickly. Now, you know, bumping it up to 256, I kind of feel like that's the better option if you're going to go the digital notebook route. Or you could, you know, buy a USB-C capable external drive to take with you. But that's another thing. It's too much trouble. So most people, if they are, I think most people who are considering the iPad mini now know exactly what they want to do with it. So I think they are probably going to be more willing to pay for the extra storage because they already have this kind of use case in mind. And anybody I know that has loved the iPad mini in the past, has owned them, like loves this size. You know, like that's one of the points I made in this review, is that it really is all about this specific size of tablet that Apple has kind of carved out this niche where people just love it. They really have like a special use cases for it. They love the portability of it. And the power in this one with the A15 Bionic processor is great. So it's like, just,
wow.
Yeah, it's a great small tablet. And if you know that that kind of fills a hole in your life, there's a very specific 8.3-inch hole in your life, you know?
iPad mini shape hole. I saw this thing. I was like, that's very cute.
It's tempting.
That's very, like, I kind of want it. And just to, like, let's backtrack to the history of, like, how did we get to the iPad mini? First of all, in, like, 2012, 2013, it was because there were a bunch of, like, 7-inch Android tablets. And everyone's like, the iPad's so hot, let's make it smaller. And Samsung and a bunch of companies, I think it was Asus actually, like Asus had the ZenPad or one of those like out there for a while. It was like $200 and they were really building up market share. And I think Apple was like, oh no, small tablets are in, we got to do something. So the original iPad mini, I think, was a really cool thing back in 2012. But with the advent of the iPad Air and everything over the last few years, like it seemed like it didn't really have a place in the like iPad landscape, whereas now the mini is just like, it's a very specific thing. If you want a bigger screen, you could get the Air.
It is the best tablet at its size, major to say, right? Like, you, what else you got? Kindle 8?
No. Well, I mean, there. It really doesn't have much competition in terms of its size in like a traditional tablet, right? But I mean, it does have, I guess, some competitions with e-readers, but that's a very different type of a device, right? Yeah. Totally different screen, totally different type of performance.
Right.
So that, I think, that will appeal to another very specific type of user.
For sure.
So speaking of the different screen, right? Can you tell me a little bit about the iPad mini screen? Because our video producer, Julio, it's curious. Like, wasn't there something like a complaint about the screen?
The complaint about the iPad mini screen? So the iPad mini screen on this one is a liquid retina display, 8.3 okay. inch liquid retina display. The 2019 version was a 7.9 inch retina display. So it's a little bit different. And from my understanding, the liquid kind of means that it just like feels like it's the all screen design. Like that's kind of what it's referring to versus the old style of design that, you know, that the old iPad mini had. So it's a perfectly fine screen, but it's nothing like the 120 hertz screens that you're going to get on iPad Pros or like even the new iPhones or anything. It's just a very suitable screen.
Don't put it next to your iPad Pro. Yeah. I've seen some reviews where somebody was like taking a photo of like the iPad Pro and the mini above it, and the mini is like you see all the like blocky LCD backlighting and the colors aren't as good. And I was like, yeah, because you're comparing it to one of the best screens that you can buy on the market right now. So don't do that to yourself. How is the audio? Because we got a question from the chat room from Zach Yeffo. How is the audio speaker? Is it good enough to just like listen to without headphones if you're watching a TV show or something?
Yeah, I definitely think it's perfectly fine to listen to if you're watching Netflix or YouTube. Like that's mainly how I was using it for a lot of the time, like in when I was doing the review. I will say that I feel like the audio kind of skewed a little bit lower. It wasn't as loud maybe as I was expecting, but then again, I don't really know what I was expecting. But it's perfectly fine. Like if you want to watch Netflix or something. I didn't really have a problem with it, but I mean, you are able to connect wireless headphones obviously to it. So, it just depends on your preference in that case. So,
I feel like that's the big thing. We have to wrap at some point because I feel like we could talk about all this stuff forever and want to be respectful of your time, Valentina. Shalyn or Valentina, like, do you guys have any thoughts about all these products overall or like iPad, the new iPad OS, the new iOS, anything?
Just make iPad mini fold. That's the discourse I've been seeing all over. Yeah, but there you go. That's my
point. I think that's kind of like what Apple's looking at, too. They're like, oh, you like this form factor, huh? How much do you like this form factor? Would you like if you could fold it into your pocket, huh? Huh? Yeah.
I will just bring up one thing about iPad OS 15 along with the iPad mini was with my experience with the Apple Pencil. So one of those new features in iPad OS 15 is that Quick Notes feature, which, you know, I don't use Apple Notes as my main note-taking kind of system. I mostly use Evernote, but this was super cool that you can just like kind of swipe up from the bottom right-hand corner of the screen, either with your finger or with the Apple Pencil, and it'll bring up this little new note and you can just kind of scribble something in it and it'll save it right into your Apple Notes. And like, I just found that super convenient and a really great feature that like, I feel like slowly over the years, Apple has been making its Notes app way more convenient and kind of, it can compete more so with like a lot of the other note-taking apps out there, particularly the ones that have, you know, like stylus support. That was a nice feature for me to use because I like taking notes with the Apple Pencil and also like doodling things out. And the Apple Pencil, second generation Apple Pencil on the iPad mini, I think is just as good as it is on any other iPad. You just have a smaller space to work with. So
does it magnetically attach to the side of the screen?
It does. It does. Okay. And it fits literally like so perfectly on, it's almost the exact same.
It's adorable.
You know, okay. It's adorable. Like it's an adorable little package, you know?
Love it overall. Let's, we will have a lot more to say about Apple eventually. But while we have you, Valentina, and while you have that thing on your wrist, just want to quickly ask, like, how is the Fitbit Charge 5 working for you?
It's been working fine. I think if the screen will light up for me. There it goes. Yeah. It's a pretty nice screen, right? It's a nice screen. The screen is probably the best like physical, like hardware thing about it. Because compared to the Charge 4 had like a grayscale OLED display. This is a full color display. So that kind of makes the Charge 5 feel more in line with all of the smartwatches that Fitbit has, even though it's not a smartwatch. This is like their main like expensive band, you know, because people still go for that sort of style. So it definitely elevates the Charge 5 in comparison to the Charge 4. So far, it's been a decent experience using the Charge 5. It's pretty similar to the Charge 4. There's not a whole ton of new features. There are a couple of new things. I think like Fitbit brought down they're going to bring down the ECG measurement feature from some of the smartwatches. They're also bringing down the EDA measurements and like stress measurement feature from some of the smartwatches. And yeah, so I've been, you know, just working out with it over the past week-ish. And so far I haven't run into a lot of huge hiccups or anything, but you know, this is $180. The Charge 5 is $180, $30 more than the Charge 4. So that is a pretty significant price bump. So yeah, you'll just have to, I'll have to formulate all my thoughts and I'll put it in the review coming soon to see like if it's really worth the update, the upgrade from the Charge 4. But so far it's a perfectly suitable fitness tracker.
I think that screen is kind of the big thing, because I remember seeing pictures of the Charge 4. I was like, this grayscale screen is making me sad. You know, we're living in a world where like we have some really nice, you know, screens all over that can fit on wrist devices. That seems like a big update for a lot of folks. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And it's great to have it on this band kind of style, because I feel like with smartwatches kind of taking things over, you know, taking over the wearable space over the past couple of years, that bands kind of are just like an afterthought. But there are people who still want that style, you know, the people who find that just more comfortable. It's a lower profile than this. I will say the Charge 5 is also just it's a lower profile than the Charge 4. It's got these kind of curved edges and it's a little bit smaller, like slimmer and stuff. So it makes it easier to wear for sure than the Charge 4. So yeah, Shilin, it hasn't been as bad to wear it to sleep at night. I will say that.
That's good.
Shilin has nightmares about the Charge 4, as I recall.
Well, nightmares about not the Charge 4. It's about all wearables that I had to test for sleep, but I do it for my job anyway, because I love you guys to know.
Is there really a wearable that's comfortable to wear to bed? Never. I don't think
there,
so.
There was. Like, yeah. There was back in the day with my beloved Jawbone Up.
The Jawbone.
The Jawbone.
Yeah. It was. Every time.
Okay. Kids these days, these TikTok kids don't know anything about the Jawbone Up.
Okay? I know. They're just like, what's that?
One last note on the Charge 5. I just want to point out that $180, and I appreciate that a good band, it's like, some people don't want smartwatches, but $180 for like about $20 more, you get the Watch Series 3, the Apple Watch Series 3.
Yes. So that's a bad. You could do that.
I mean, that's a shit. Yeah, that's not the best watch anymore.
You could do that. Outdated. Yeah, like, I probably wouldn't recommend that.
Worse for fitness. It just has a bigger screen. That's like the main benefit.
So, AKA,
right?
Yeah, Apple should really just get rid of it already. But
yes,
I do still think that like the Charge 5 is quite expensive for what it is. A lot of the bands that I know are $150, and I'm sure there's better, like there's also cheaper options from like Garmin and other like fitness brands out there.
Yeah, there are. And I mean, it's just going to come down to if all of the new features and the new design really mean that much to you. And also, I will say that at least a couple of the features that Fitbit kind of promoted with the Charge 5 are coming soon, and they're still coming soon. So like, I haven't been able to test out a couple of them because I can't, you know?
Yeah.
So that's another thing that I think is a bit of a bummer.
I hate that trend, just because I guess it's so hard to get updates out during the pandemic and everything. Well, Valentina, I'm looking forward to reading the full Fitbit Charge 5 review. That's going to be coming soon. Thank you for chatting with us. Where can we find your work on the internet these days?
Yes, at Valentina Lucia, and also Engadget Deals specifically, at Engadget Deals for all of the deals.
Follow both, but follow Valentina's Twitter account, because surely she does more than just deals. Looking in your background, Valentina, like all the boxes, like I feel that pain. That is
same.
That is
all the boxes. Right, and I will say they're not all my boxes. I do live with a fiance, so they are some of his boxes as well, but I have to take credit for some of them, unfortunately.
So many boxes. Thank you, Valentina.
Thanks so much, guys.
All right, folks. In other news, there's actually something breaking that's happening as we are recording this. The European Commission has proposed basically a requirement that all phone manufacturers use USB-C charging. Saying
hooray!
That's major. Hooray!
If this comes through.
They're aiming to like reduce e-waste and solve a big problem for consumers, because it's really inconvenient to have all these different things out there. This is a great idea. And I think we've even mentioned something like this for a while. I've been waiting for the iPhone to go USB-C.
Jeez,
we've seen some of the iPads are now. So kind of Apple is kind of slowly getting there. What do you think about this, Sherlyn, as our like mobile goddess right now?
Oh my God. First of all, put that on my tombstone.
Wow.
Mobile goddess.
Oh my God. I shouldn't even just like throw these titles out there, because that's all Sherlyn's going to focus on.
You can call me mobile chonkster. I love this. I have USB-C on everything now. My laptops, my phones, MacBook and Windows PCs both use USB-C power. Like, it's insane that I still have to keep this one different device everywhere, a different cable everywhere I go just for the iPhones. So I think the EU being the place to start for this is actually kind of also, I guess, expected because they've also been ahead with GDPR and all that stuff. So I don't know. I feel like this, like our article says, may signal the end of Lightning. And you know what? Good riddance.
Listen, folks. I think any like hardcore iPhone user knows the fastest way to charge your phone is you got to get the USB-C power adapter and you have to get the USB-C cable to Lightning because it turns out USB-C is a far better power delivery platform. Let Lightning die. I actually remember when Apple started moving towards Lightning, when was that? It was like 2013, 2014 even. But when that was happening and away from like the old wide connector, which was just a pain, those things sucked. I was on like CNBC or something. I think it was on with like Lance Ulanoff, who was head of PC Mag at that point. We had this debate about it. I do remember like him and a lot of other people were like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if Apple has its own thing. Let them introduce Lightning. And I was like, no. No, USB-C exists. USB-C is a common standard, and it's going to be easier for people to develop accessories and stuff for it rather than having this like really convoluted made for iPhone program where people have to license Lightning connections. None of that. The USB-C same size, better power, but yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that I just think that even when, and I think it's when Apple makes the switch to USB-C over Lightning, it will still do something that makes its version of USB-C a little different from the rest for some reason.
Sure.
Because it still wants to make that proprietary thing happen. And also a good point that was brought up in our chat by, I believe, Jonathan Anderson, not all USB-Cs are equal. This is true. There's USB 3, USB 4, etc. So even then, there's some way to kind of differentiate between USBs. But at the very least, have them be backward compatible.
It's the same plug.
It's the same cable. One cable will work. It's fine.
One cable. It's not perfect, as you're pointing out, especially for like laptops, because some laptops, like right now, I've been testing the XPS 15. That ships with like a 65-watt USB-C charger. If I plug in the MacBook Air's 30-watt charger, it still charges, but it complains. It's like, hey, this not enough power. And that stuff is not super consumer friendly. But hey, that's annoying. I think even more annoying is like the Thunderbolt stuff, because it's like, it's USB-C, plus it's Thunderbolt on top of that, but it's the same connector, but not all USB-C is Thunderbolt, but all Thunderbolt is USB-C. It's all these big companies. Like, Intel's ruining that. Yeah. Apple's ruining that. What's up?
Yep. Sorry. The simple fact that I have one brick, but like two USB cables, one with USB-C in and Lightning out, and then one with USB-C in, C out. Like, what? Like, come on. Like, why do I have to have this extra one? I don't want to peek. Anyway, frustrations.
Yeah. right now, I have one of my favorite, like, portable laptop chargers. I think it's from Rav Power, but it has, like, a couple of USB-A ports and several USB-Cs, and it does, like, up to 90 watts of power, so, like, it can charge pretty much anything. It shouldn't be this way. It shouldn't have to be this way. Mm-hmm, it could be a lot simpler if everything was USB-C, and I think because the iPads are getting there, we're going to see on the phones eventually.
Yes.
It just make our lives easier.
Ish. Yes. Anyway, yes. It was serious hardware season this week. We're no longer calling it Techtober, you guys. We're calling it Tech Fall.
Tech
so
fall.
Catchy. I'll come up with something. Okay, we'll figure
something.
It out. But yeah, in addition to it being iPhone Reviews Week and Microsoft Surface Event Week, there was a whole bunch of other stuff. There was a new Kindle Paperwhite announced with some big updates, like some among the biggest updates to Kindle Paperwhites in a while. And then we know there's a Nintendo event later today as of this recording. Don't know what we'll see. I think it's more of a games show because it's
more
a Nintendo
games.
Direct.
More games.
Yeah. But
we are getting close to the Switch OLED launch, so there's going to be more stuff coming out of that for sure, eventually.
Yes, yes. And while we hate giving this company any airtime whatsoever, it is worth noting that Facebook has got a new portal smart display.
Portal.
So it's called a Portal Bow. Bow. No.
Bow.
It doesn't work.
Bow's not a name.
Portal Bull. You know, like portable, but portable. It does not work. Okay. It does not work. Anyway.
It's called the Portal Go.
It's called the Portal Go.
It's $199.
Like a Surface Go. $200. Yeah.
It's funny that this is, they're still on this. Apparently these devices have been successful, even though like nobody should trust Facebook with a video chat or anything. It is funny that the center stage stuff from Apple is basically the same thing, where it uses software to like focus you and follow you during a video call or something. So
yeah,
everyone's doing it.
I mean, Google does it too on its Nest Hub devices too. Yeah, for sure.
Yep. Yep. For sure. But we should mention, and we didn't get to talk about this last week, but the Wall Street Journal has had a really good selection of stories called the Facebook Files that has a lot of inside info. And if you hear us complaining about Facebook, or if you hear me, I was on This Week in Tech this past weekend. I feel like I went into full rant mode against Facebook because of some of these things. But this company is terrible. This company stinks, and they keep lying to us about what they do. So among these stories, right, they revealed that Facebook has very different rules about how it treats celebrities and elite users. They revealed that Facebook knows Instagram is toxic for many teen girls. Like, it is directly contributing to bullying and also suicide rates. They know they try to, like, fix the algorithm, I believe, at some point to like make it less contentious. And then they ended up making the algorithm worse and meaner when all of a sudden you had to be negative in your stories to get like better lift in Facebook. People try to flag drug cartels and human traffickers like working within the platform. And the company was like, what do you want us to do about it? Everything.
So annoying, frustrating.
They're doing. Yeah.
I know personally in my real world social circles, I know at least 3 or 4 people that work for Facebook and are all dying to get out. They just hate it. It is insane. The culture there seems toxic as hell. So I'm not surprised. So we do hate Facebook for these reasons. It is toxic as shit, doing all the wrong things. But they made a new hardware thing, so I'm just saying.
Well, that's the thing. So when we talked about the glasses, right, the Ray-Ban
stories,
it's like you cannot separate the hardware that Facebook is producing. And I like the Oculus Quest quite a bit too. But you can't separate this hardware from what Facebook is doing as a company. And in some ways, it seems like that's what the company wants to do. Like, there's a story this week now at the New York Times about Facebook saying, like, we're going to just send more pro-Facebook stories into the newsfeed. That's going to solve our problem. You know, instead of, like, addressing the issues that a lot of reporters have brought up using CrowdTangle data — CrowdTangle is a company they own — they split up the people working on CrowdTangle, so it would be less useful as a service. Just everything, folks. Like, I don't know. This is why I'm worried about Facebook smart glasses. These things are still sitting here.
Right.
It's a toxic dump. And also, they build things and they kind of hurt society in a way. They don't care to fix it. Like, that is the thing that really gets me. If they built a huge social network and they're like, oh, this got bigger than we assumed. Like, we could not have foreseen that things would get here and actively work to fix it, I feel like I would feel a lot better about what Facebook is doing. But that generally what they're doing is being defensive and ignoring it. And there was news yesterday, too, about Facebook changing up their CTO. Andrew Bosworth is the new CTO, or will be the new CTO of Facebook, starting next year, I believe. And that is a clear sign. That is the guy behind Oculus. That is the guy behind the glasses. Actually, like, every hardware thing Facebook has done, he is a part of. Like, he is the big product guy. So it almost seems like the future of Facebook is we're a metaverse company. We're gonna look over here, you know, at all this hardware and cool glasses and VR, and that flaming pile of trash behind us, the social network, we're just gonna walk away from that. We're just gonna, like, not even deal with it.
I want to say, so in our chat, there are two things I want to point out. One is Sir Holmes says, hashtag delete Facebook. I have done that. I mean, I got off of Facebook ages ago. I just couldn't deal with it anymore. Toxic as hell. But Mark Dell in our chat, who's one of our regular audience members too, says, would all these Facebook things make you consider moving away from Instagram? And honestly,
yeah,
I want to. It's hard. We've talked about this before where it's really hard to quit Facebook's two biggest apps, in my opinion, Instagram and WhatsApp.
Or WhatsApp.
WhatsApp is the hardest one because it keeps me connected to my family, and I can't get my parents to go to another app. They just won't. They just can't. They just don't know how to do it because their friends are all there too on WhatsApp. So it's reach around the world that Facebook has is huge. So as much as I want to quit things like WhatsApp,
that won't solve it. That won't solve it. Like
it won't. Yeah.
This is the thing. It's like the climate crisis, right? You can quit Facebook. You can protest it and do everything. And everybody should speak up about it. But quitting it, just like making sure you recycle and never produce any trash, will not fix the bigger problem. The bigger problem is this is a company that built a monstrosity that they don't know what to deal with.
Like if we all en masse completely 100% all quit Facebook, sure, I'm sure that's an impact to them. But that's not going to happen. That's not feasible. The more likely thing that will happen is some big organization or regulation or authority is going to have to enforce something. So or investigate something. And it's thankfully the journal is at least publishing investigative stories about the company. So that's a step in the right direction. Yeah.
There's more reporting around it. I know people within Facebook are really frustrated too, and the company is facing more internal dissent. So we've got a lot of stuff.
Hey, speaking of a lot of stuff, what are you working on, DaVinci?
What am I working on? So much. I have a review of the Dell's new XPS 15 coming up soon. It will likely publish today when we are recording this. So the big difference is it's the same design as last year, which was a big redesign. But this one has an OLED screen. And the OLED screen is spectacular. I love a good screen. It's OLED.
Yes.
3.5K. Has Dolby Vision. It looks incredible. So it's not fully 4K, but still looks really good. Like I played a bunch of like trailers and movies, some content you'll see in our review from the movie Gemini Man, which everybody hates, but I think is a really cool tech demo because there are clips out there of it in 4K, 60 FPS, which with HDR. And looking at it is just kind of unreal. Like go look at it on your phone or your computers, folks. Look, it's on YouTube. Like there's some chase sequences and stuff. It looks wild. Not as good as it does in the theater or as it did in the theater, but it still looks cool. I'm really digging the XPS 15. I will eventually be checking out the new Sonos Beam soundbar as well. That is the one with Dolby Atmos integration that should be getting here today. I hope it gets here today because I have to work on this review. Fingers crossed. So I'm going to be looking at that. I'm also going to be getting in the Sonos Arc to play with and just to really compare. Is there a big difference when it comes to Atmos and things like that? So we will see how all that goes. Sherlyn, what are you not working on? How about that?
I'm not working on me. I'm not working on, you know, I talked to my therapist and he was like, why is your priority your work? I don't know, girl. Anyway, I am working on finishing up the iPhone Pro review, which will be up by the time this podcast episode is on all the sound channels. And then we have, like I said, Tech Temperature. And basically, we've got more events coming up, right? Next week, we've got Amazon, I believe, on Wednesday or Tuesday. I probably don't have to work as hard on that as I have on Apple, Google, and Samsung. But speaking of Google, there's a Search On event next week as well. We will be covering that.
Everybody stop.
I know. Y'all, companies, listen. Apple, there's rumors that Apple still has another event coming up, which is very true. But it's probably going to happen. Because
they get to update those MacBooks. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And then all the devices that got announced, whether it's Microsoft, whether it's Apple's watch that we still haven't seen, are going to be coming in at some point. So we're going to continue reviewing those. I'm just trying to catch a break at some point and maybe sleep a little bit someday and take care of me.
Take care of you, please. That, the gadgets can wait. Chat room, tell Sherlyn to take care of herself, please.
Never.
It's too crazy. Let's move on to our pop culture picks. What do you got this week?
I got nothing this week, so I went back into my archive. And for a period of time there, when I was able to take a break, I actually found, I think people on this podcast know in the past that I don't really like animated shows. But I've, like I said, discovered the beauty of cartoons a little bit. And it's not just the adult animated things like Harley Quinn that I mentioned earlier, too. It's also just all these Disney movies that I started watching, Moana.
That's self-care. That is like you taking care of yourself.
That is so
just
soothing. I saw Frozen for the first time and Frozen 2. Oh, so anyway, my recommendation though is one of the movies I love the most that I watched ever since I got Disney Plus, which was like almost a year ago now. Monsters, Inc. was a really good movie, but the reason I love Monsters, Inc. was because of the baby girl. She's so cute. Mm-hmm. And I wanted more from that world. I just was like, oh my gosh, I need these cute baby sounds. And then I realized that they have extra content and Disney Plus has a series called Monsters at Work. It's just
now
a kid's show.
You're watching kids shows.
A full
you're
on
watching
kids show.
TV.
Yeah, but I love it. I would just play it on in the background. It soothes me. It puts me to sleep nicely. It's got this nice message of being in a team and you know, caring for the underdogs.
There's something really soothing about kids shows. I don't know if it's just like the hell of parenting, you know, and dealing with like a real life little boo. Yeah. But watching a good kids show with my daughter, like Bluey is a good one. I'll give you some kids shows for self-soothing. How about that? And that is Bluey, which is a really chill show and really cool and love the characters.
Okay,
but also, we just, my chill animated thing is like just go back and watch like a lot of like Studio Ghibli movies.
Oh, Ghibli. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like, Kiki's Delivery Service is so chill.
I do enjoy the Pixar stuff a lot. So Monsters at Work on Disney Plus is my recommendation this week if you want that sort of soft, warm wrapping around your heart.
It's really nice.
How about you, Dev?
There's a lot to read into about you regressing basically right now.
Don't read into it.
But I'll save that for another time. I wanted to shout out Star Wars Visions, which is the new animated, and I don't know if you're going to be into this, Erlyn, but it's a new animated show on Disney Plus. It is sort of like, if you remember what the Animatrix did with the Matrix, like they were side stories by major anime studios at the time. I love the Animatrix. I also remember at that point being like, damn, it is really funny to see this come full circle, because I spent most of the 90s being in this weird subculture that very few people knew about. Like there were anime shows on TV. There was actually Saturday anime on Sci-Fi channel, but it was still, and you guys get it all. But in America, it was like still a very new up and coming thing. So I had the only place I could really talk about anime was like on the internet with like random people
from my part of the world, probably
from your part of the world, but no, across like the US and Canada too. Like
true.
We all kind of banded together because it was this little subculture that wasn't really huge. Then the Matrix happened and then we were like, oh, this is just Ghost in the Shell. This is every Hong Kong action movie. And then like those cultures, those like genres basically started to become mainstream. So the Animatrix was this great, like, coming full circle thing of anime looking at the Matrix, which itself was influenced by anime. So the same is true for Star Wars Visions, because guess what? George Lucas was heavily inspired by Kurosawa films for the original trilogy. Like beat for beat, like the Hidden Fortress is Star Wars. So seeing anime studios, including big ones like Production IG and Studio Trigger, kind of in the Star Wars universe, I think is completely wild to me. I've only seen a couple episodes so far, but they're all like 15-20 minute vignettes of Star Wars stories. So people have the Force, there are lightsabers and stuff, and like the basics of Star Wars are there, but they're usually, it's like their own worlds. So it's like the first one is set in like almost like a feudal looking Japan, because it's set like after the feudal Jedi Empire, which is something that's supposed to take place long before the film. But it's very like, it looks like a samurai movie. You know, it looks like very specifically it's about a Ronin going in and saving this village, because that's what you do in every samurai movie or Western. It looks so cool. The animation's fantastic. And I think it's just a great use of the Star Wars world. Like, I think Star Wars is best when you're playing around with it and not when you're trying to figure out like who is who's granddaughter or something. Like, I don't care about that. I care about like the ideas in this world. So check out Star Wars Visions. It is definitely worth a watch. And I think it's a better like side story show than What If, which is the other one that's happening with the MCU. Yeah. Some of those have been good, and some of those have been
hit or miss.
I hate the animation. I hate the way it looks. Mm-hmm. The Black Panther one was good. The Black Panther like Star-Lord one was good. Beyond that, not so much. So anyway, check out Star Wars Visions. It is now on Disney Plus, and all the episodes are live, so you can binge it whenever you want.
Well, that's it for the episode this week, everyone. Thank you, as always, for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at
Devendra on Twitter and at the Filmcast Podcast at thefilmcast.com.
If you want to send me recommendations for the cuddliest of kids' cartoons, I'm at Sherlinlow on Twitter. Email us your thoughts at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts, including Spotify.
We'd like to take a second to thank our sponsor, Mouser Electronics. Not only does Mouser stock the world's widest selection of semiconductors and electronic components, they also offer an original content series called Empowering Innovation Together. Each month, EIT takes a deep dive into the hottest tech trends, and this month the focus is on intelligent transportation systems. Check out podcasts, articles, infographics, videos, and more at mouser.com/empowering-innovation.
Oh my god, first of all, put that on my tombstone, mobile goddess? Okay.